Hello, and welcome to Sonnetcast, William Shakespeare's sonnets recited, revealed, and relived. I am Sebastian Michael, and this is Sonnet 64. When I have seen by time's fell hand defaced the rich, proud cast of outworn, buried age, when sometime lofty towers I see downraised, and brass eternal slave to mortal rage, when I have seen the hungry ocean gain advantage on the kingdom of the shore, and the firm soil win of the watery main, increasing store with loss, and loss with store, when I have seen such interchange of state, or state itself confounded to decay, ruin hath taught me thus to ruminate, that time will come and take my love away. This thought is as a death which cannot choose but weep to have that which it fears to lose. With his moving, melancholy sonnet 64, William Shakespeare continues an ongoing meditation on time, but unlike other sonnets that have gone before or that are soon to come, he here finds no redemption in his own writing or hope in the prospect of being able to lend his lover longevity beyond his presence on the planet through poetry. The sonnet thus offers the perhaps most profoundly troubled perspective yet on the passing of time, and with its sincerity paves the way for further heartfelt articulations of what it is to be William Shakespeare in a world where things go awry. What then does Sonnet 64 actually mean? When I have seen by time's fell hand defaced the rich, proud cast of outworn, buried age, when I have seen how cruel or ruthless time defaces or damages the lavish, extravagantly splendid, and also flashy, showy, perhaps ostentatious objects that were once expensive and are now worn out with their age and buried in forgotten and disused oblivion. In other words, when I see how time by and by lets everything disintegrate and ultimately decay, even things we once valued greatly and paid a high price for. The applicable dictionary definition of fell here is, quote, of terrible evil or ferocity, deadly, end of quote, from Oxford Languages. We don't really see it used as an adjective in that sense anymore today, but a remnant of it resides in the phrase in one fell swoop, although for us it no longer has a by necessity bad or let alone evil connotation. When sometime lofty towers I see downraised, when I see lofty, for which read tall but also proud, and again perhaps ostentatious, showy, towers raised to the ground, implied is that they are raised to the ground also by the ravages of time itself, or indeed by the adversities that come over time, such as falling into disuse or prey to the consuming force of fire, or to a hostile power laying siege to a town and damaging tall structures to the point where they collapse. The sometime here can be read as either belonging to the lofty towers, so they are towers that were at one time lofty but are now raised to the ground, or as belonging to the instance of seeing, as in when from time to time I come across a once lofty tower that has now been raised to the ground. The fact alone, though, that the tower so imagined is now no longer standing suggests that, while a secondary meaning may be entirely intended, the primary meaning really has to be the former, when icy towers that were at some time in the past lofty, now razed to the ground. And brass eternal slave to mortal rage. And when I see brass, which is meant to be a durable material, be slave to the forces of deadly destruction, which, as always, is brought about by time itself. Eternal also offers two possible readings, both of which may be intentional, either as an adjective belonging to brass, in the sense of brass eternal, placed after the noun it describes, the way we might say arrogance supreme, for example, or as an adjective to describe the kind of slave it becomes, as in an eternal slave. Editors, in fact, also refer to it in this latter context as an adverb, in the sense of brass being eternally slave to mortal rage. When I have seen the hungry ocean gain advantage on the kingdom of the shore, when I have seen how the ocean, hungry as it is because it is forever lapping on the land, gain advantage, meaning win over, the kingdom of the shore by swallowing up land and turning previously firm soil into sea, and the firm soil win of the watery main, and when I have seen the firm soil in turn at other times and in other places encroach on the sea, for example, when a volcano erupts and suddenly creates an island, or over time by depositing silt and taking back land, as it were, increasing store with loss and loss with store, and in this everlasting battle one loses and the other gains or wins, and then the losses and gains are reversed. Shakespeare underlines the grand futility of this continuous exchange by allowing the store or gain to be increased with loss, and the loss to be increased with gain. So there is no real gain and no real loss, because both increase each other in an eternal cycle that is forever undone. When I have seen such interchange of state, or state itself confounded to decay, when I have observed such a continuous exchange of states, meaning conditions or states of being, land turning into sea, sea turning into land, or indeed state itself, for which here read the institutions of the state, kingdoms, courts, entire political constructs, the great empires themselves, ruined to utter decay and thus non-existence. We noted very recently in the last episode on Sonnet 63 the numerous uses of confound to mean variants of destroy. And state in the second line here can also additionally, of course, be read as simply the condition of being, whereby the line then turns into a summary of how everything that is in a state of being ultimately surrenders to decay. Nothing speaks against Shakespeare aiming for this double meaning, but here we have another close reference to Arthur Golding's translation of Ovid's Metamorphoses that would appear to have strongly influenced Will in composing his own verse. E'en so have places oftentimes exchanged their state, for I have seen it sea which was substantial ground laid. Again, where sea was, I have seen the same become dry land, and shells and scales of sea fish far have lain from any strand, and in the tops of mountains high old anchors have been found. This is from Book 15, lines 287 to 289 in the Golding translation, whereby a late means before, as in which was substantial ground before. Ruin hath taught me thus to ruminate, that time will come and take my love away. Having seen, watched, and observed all this, its common feature, ruin, has taught me to ponder the following thought: time will come and take my love away, whereby love here stands for the lover, although if the lover is gone, then so, of course, is love. This thought is as a death which cannot choose but weep to have that which it fears to lose. This thought that time will come and take my love away is like a death to me, and this thought, the which in the first line, cannot help but weep at having something that it fears to lose. The thought here becomes synonymous with the writer, because it is I, the poet, of course, who weeps at the thought of losing my love. We find our will in a frame of mind here that has started to take a dim view of life. Since Sonnet 60, a tone and a mood have begun to take hold, which more than hint at William Shakespeare not being in a happy place, and Sonnet 64 makes him sound saddest so far. As with every other sonnet we have looked at, we cannot know what exactly it is that brings on this fatigue. What we can say is that both tone and mood, much as the theme of Sonnet 64, sit snugly embedded in a group of similarly atmosphered sonnets that support each other and reveal much the same preoccupations. We have already on several previous occasions tried to formulate a framework, if that's the right word, for the kind of conditions that may lead a poet like Shakespeare to get so agitated about his age, about the evident age difference between him and his young lover, and about a passing of time that he seems to be experiencing more and more urgently as time simply running out. One of the possible reasons we have put forward is his either rapidly advancing on or having just stepped across the, to many a man, meaningful threshold of 30, an age which in terms of life expectancy in the late 16th century would have been the approximate equivalent to someone hitting 50 or even 60 today. It would be tempting now, with Shakespeare reaching this nadir in his disposition, to delve further into the timing of the sonnets and how they can be brought into a coherent constellation with known events in Shakespeare's life, including him reaching easily established age milestones at a given time. But if we hold on to this thought for a little while longer, we will once more be richly rewarded, because over the next few sonnets, we shall see Shakespeare go through a profound crisis in multiple respects, and this will prove to be of great significance for our understanding not only of Shakespeare the man and of his relationship with the young lover, but very specifically also of the time frame we are most likely dealing with. But we will come back to this, and we will also at that point be able to draw together a few fascinating external facts which we have not before seen fit to bring into the equation, but which, in the context of what is about to unfold, will be increasingly relevant and therefore impossible to ignore. Sonnet 64 is easily one of my favourite sonnets of them all, mostly because it shows us Shakespeare at his most vulnerable and bare. There is no flattering the young man here, there is no elevating his own writing or deprecating it for poetic effect. There is no hyperbole and no demonstrative cleverness. There is, yes, great dexterity, of course, and there are some instances where, as we noted earlier, a line or a word may have more than one meaning, but even where that's the case, there is really nothing performative about it all. Shakespeare, with Sonnet 64, does not appear to set out to prove anything or to impress anyone, to win any favour or to plead, as he called it in Sonnet 23, for love. The sonnet doesn't even come across as necessarily meant for anyone other than the poet himself to know of and read. About this, we cannot even speculate. There is virtually nothing that can tell or even suggest to us whether Shakespeare ever showed or read or sent this to anyone, including the young man, or anyone else for that matter, here referred to. On its own, and the poem can absolutely stand on its own and is not paired strongly to either Sonnet 63 or Sonnet 65, this sonnet doesn't go anywhere. It finds no resolution. Its conclusion, such as it is, does not solve anything. This changes somewhat if we take it in its setting within the collection and view it as, if not paired with, then certainly linked to both Sonnet 63 and Sonnet 65. Doing so shows us something of a vector that leads us all the way from Sonnet 60, which initiates the theme of time for this group, past Sonnet 61, which really has a different primary concern that is not directly related to this, through the self-knowledge and supposed self-love of Sonnet 62, into Sonnet 63, which contrasts Will's own age and state of being with that of the young man, and presents poetry as the means to forestall the young man turning into what would otherwise be his fate, one day being as old and as wrinkled as Will. From there into this realization that, the power of poetry notwithstanding, time will still spell an end at one point to the love that is now alive, and into Sonnet 65, which then no longer asserts that the verse of Shakespeare will keep the young man alive, but invokes this as a miracle that can at best be hoped and wished, perhaps, in a way, also prayed for. For this reason alone, and beyond that because there is no good reason to do otherwise, it makes sense to read Sonnet 64 as part of this group that has its own internal, if subtle, trajectory. This also, and quite incidentally, solves, in inverted commas, the issue, if one were to consider it such, that Sonnet 64 is another one of those sonnets which could in theory be about anyone. On the surface, and in isolation, this is of course true. Nowhere in the sonnet do we learn who this love is that time will take away from our will. But in its natural, logical, and therefore entirely plausible context, the question answers itself. It is in all reasonable likelihood about the same love as Sonnet 63, which we know for certain is a young man. If Sonnet 64 suggests that things are not so good right now, they are about to get a whole lot worse, but not immediately. Sonnet 65, as just outlined, can be thought of as essentially a continuation of this consideration on time, but with Sonnet 66, William Shakespeare blasts open a door into a region of his mind that we have not yet visited, and there, in the spatial and temporal aftermath, so to metaphorically speak, introduces us to a whole new league of lament and foreboding. As ever, you can find at sonnetcast.com the sonnets we've discussed so far, the transcripts of this podcast, a contact form should you wish to get in touch, a donate button should you find yourself suddenly flush and overcome with generosity, and a link to subscribe to the email list that I'm beginning to build for Sonnetcast. The principal purpose of the latter is to be able to inform you if and when Sonnet Talks go live. Sonnet Talks is something I'm considering doing in the foreseeable future, a series of live talks online that would provide a more succinct introduction to various topics that relate to the sonnets. Above all, though, I do hope you will join me again here on SonnetCast, where we recite, reveal, and relive the sonnets of William Shakespeare.